Hello and welcome to episode 31 of Tabletop Game Talk, a show where we talk about tabletop games of all types. I'm one of your hosts, Josh.
I'm Chris.
I'm Kitty.
Today we'll be talking about Kickstarter. Love it, hate it, don't know about it. Whatever the case, we'll be talking about it. But first, as always, we'll start off topic.
Was that an American accent?
Just a little bit.
No, it was not.
Well, see, I just wanted to do sort of an ode to what Fletcher was...
Fletcher, yes.
Was doing last week when he did, you know...
The Blimey.
He did a Blimey to sort of reference me. And it was very nice, and I appreciate it.
Yeah.
I just wanted to do a little corny...
Yeah, that sounded just like you were from Austin.
Yeah, not at all.
Even though I was just there.
No, yeah. We got to work on that American accent.
Yeah, I know.
So... we are off topic already. I wanted to clean up the whole off topic segment. You've already destroyed us. It's good. Let's start with thanking our friends of the show from our Patreon. Emil Jiljam, Jaquin Hagar, which I found out is not a real person, and I should have known.
I knew it when I heard it last week. I was like, that's a character from Game of Thrones.
Yes.
I chose not to point it out.
It's still, that's what it says in the Patreon. That's what we're going to say. Mm. Maybe we just have a famous... patron. That's gonna happen.
Yeah. Shane Poole. Fictional patrons.
Thank you, Shane. And our newest friend of the show, George. Also thanks to our newest patron, Tom Bly, who sent us a question, and that's our quick question this week. So we'll get to that in a little bit. Let's see. So we've gotten a little bit of feedback on our off-topic segment. So what I'm gonna try to do is kind of clean this up a little bit. So we're gonna be a huge contrast to last week. We're going to be a little bit more official in our segments this week. So we're going to start with some quick news and announcements that aren't directly related to any of our topics. So we call this news and announcements. Our Gloomhaven contest is over. Thank you for everyone who entered. We had over 80 entries. I think I had over 170 emails. Most people helped out by filling out the database entry on the website. So all of that went out very smoothly. Brandon now has, he doesn't have it. He has a tracking number. It's on its way. So I think FedEx charges $1 per pound because that's basically how much it costs to ship it. So, but again, thank you for everyone who participated in the Gloomhaven contest. Related, Isaac just posted that he's not going to do the Gloomhaven, actual Gloomhaven game with the founders of Gloomhaven. He's going to separate them because he wants more time to do Gloomhaven, founders of Gloomhaven. So as we record this, this is the 19th of March. I believe he's planning on the 30th of March or right around there launching the Gloomhaven reprint Kickstarter. And he's trying to do something very ambitious, which is release a scenario a day. And the feedback from when people play the scenario will drive the next scenario. So it'd be like a real-time campaign during the Kickstarter. So there's been a little bit of feedback on Board Game Geek as to whether or not anyone could actually keep up with that or not, or how crazy he is. But that's his current plan, so stay tuned. Our newest contest, though, is currently running. Sponsored by Stronghold Games, we are giving away Fields of Green. And I'm going to say this because it's going to force me to do this. I've done a reboxing video, and if you want to know what a reboxing video is, watch it on YouTube. You can go to our website, tabletopgametalk.com, click on the YouTube button, and it'll take you right to our channel. I've done a 60-second setup, which turns out to be about 90 seconds, so I'm going to rename those. I've also done a 5 to 7 minute intro to how to play the game. So three really short videos that you can watch to hear about more about Fields of Green. And to enter the Fields of Green, just go to our website, tabletopgametalk.com, click on giveaways, and if you have not entered a giveaway before, you'll just fill out the whole form. If you have entered a giveaway before, then use your personal link, and you just need to fill out the two fields. One is, yes, I want to enter the Fields of Green contest, and the other one I'm basically soliciting show topics. Not that we're running out, but you guys come up with good ideas, so I'm crowdsourcing the topics. Also, since it's sponsored by Stronghold, I feel it's to mention that Great Western Trail has been reprinted. It's out. Terraforming Mars is reprinted and out. Terraforming Mars is great. Great Western Trail, I just played for the first time with Sydney yesterday. That game is phenomenal.
You've been making me feel like I need to play it for a while now.
I'm not a Western fan. I like cows are great and stuff, but like you see a deck of cards and there's a bunch of cows and stuff, you're like, okay, whatever. It was just one of the most funs I've had.
I think it's good.
I wasn't going to call you on it.
One of the most fun I've had in any kind of like point salad-ish game. Sydney and I were playing for like a, it took us just over an hour and a half to do a two-player game. And we're like, I have no idea who's going to win, but I'm having so much fun, I don't care. Like, oh, wow. That's how the game felt.
Yeah, your reaction was really strong when you were telling me about it. I was like, wow. And so is this like a new game or is this like a reprint of an old game?
It's a new game. It came out last year, but it sold out. And now it's
very
back.
Very quickly.
Yeah. Right. Yep. But now it's back. I picked it up at a game store a couple weeks ago, but I think you can order it. I saw from Stronghold Games' website you can order it there. So it's a... Don't let the theme fool you. If you don't like cowboys and westerns and whatever, you're still going to love this game if you like point salad games. If you don't like adding up all the points at the end of the game, it's not your game. But if you do, it could become your favorite game.
I always recommend giving it a try anyway, especially if you like westerns, which I do. I watched all of Westworld in like a day.
Yeah. Yeah. There was no...
Which
cows,
is not but strictly a Western, but no. Close enough.
Yeah.
I like real ones, too.
Yeah, there needs to be a point salad game based on Westworld. We'll get on that. Let's see. Quick weight update. I'm 190.2, so I'm down a pound and a half this week, so 24.8 overall.
Yeah, and I'm 174.4, which means I'm 1.7 up, down 8.9 overall, and that's because I went to Austin, Texas and drank and ate a lot.
Yeah, we drank and ate a lot. Two.
Just for a day, though.
Just for a day. You missed out.
I know. It was an amazing show. I watched the first 10 minutes, and I haven't had the chance to listen to the rest of it.
Thanks for reminding me. So, yes. Actually, we'll do this in feedback. So, Josh, why don't you...
Take us away.
Yeah. Oh, sure. So, let's go to some feedback about past episodes. And if you have feedback about this or any previous episodes, email us at tabletalkgametalk@gmail.com and become part of the conversation.
Awesome. So we got a few Twitter messages. Josh, you try to read this one.
Okay. So from Rudy on Twitter, tis, 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 tabletop game talk. WTF, who plays D&D with pen and paper? Pencil all day, every day. He also adds, OMG, you're wasted.
Yes.
True story.
I believe Fletcher. I'm pretty sure he had to have said pen and paper.
I mean, I might have said it just because it's a phrase. You say, I would say it about doing a crossword too, but once again, you would never do a crossword in pen. But as opposed to a digital, there's pen and papers. It's a phrase. I'm going to give it to us.
All right.
I'm being generous.
I formally apologize to the D&D community. We don't play D&D with pens.
We use mechanical pencils. They feel a little bit like pens.
Those are a little bit like pens. That's good.
They're like an in-between.
Yeah.
All right. So from George, you described flippy cup wrong. It's bottom down, and then you try to flip it top down.
Yeah, we went back and forth on this a couple times.
I feel like everything I know about flippy cup, I learned from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. So I have to go back and rewatch that episode. Well, sorry, guys.
George also sent us a little animation of a stick figure playing flippy cup. so it is indeed bottom down, flip it to lip down, and the first team that gets them all lip down wins.
Megan says, oh my god, your drinking game's perfect for the train ride home.
We're glad that you guys like the drinking game episode. We would love, well, I don't think we could handle it. We would, our livers would not take it, but it'd be fun to do every episode.
Well, we have to at least do one more because I'm really gutted I missed it. No. Like, I want to be part of the fun.
No, you missed out.
I'm just going to get drunk anyway. There's just going to be tons of episodes of me getting drunk on my own.
I like that.
This segues really nicely into our next email from Enzo. I believe there was some chatter and comments from the listeners about how quiet Kitty can be. Then along came the drinking episode, and Kitty suddenly transforms to Chatty Cathy. Hilarious. Great show. However, for future episodes, I recommend you give Kitty a few pours of sparkling magic juice to keep the show lively. Great fun, guys.
And so I agree. Right now she is actually just drinking tea, though. It's caffeinated, right?
No.
No.
It's chamomile.
Oh, dear.
All right, to be fair, it's sleepy time for me.
You have at least another 50 minutes, and then you can go take a nap. Until then, lively for the listeners.
I'm away. snake.
There you go. So I did want to note on feedback. We're going to try to keep the feedback section related to past episodes. We really want to encourage the conversation. So if you have any feedback on any of our past episodes, please send it our way. If you disagree with us, if you agree with us, if you think we said something wrong, which apparently is a trend from last episode at least, let us know. And
I can't imagine why that would be.
I have no idea. That said, thanks, Charlie Volpe. You hope You're working your way through the episode starting from one on. So he emailed me when he listened to episode four. He's like, I like the change in format. I'm like, I'll talk to you again in 25 episodes. So 27 episodes.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow, we've been doing this a while.
All right. So let's go to a quick question from one of our listeners. This is a question that won't fill an entire show topic, but we think is interesting nonetheless. Today's question comes from Tom Bly. He asks, is it okay for a player to concede a game that they know they are going to lose, presumably to get to the next game? Or does that steal thunder from the presumed victor and somehow diminish their victory? Essentially, should all games be played out in entirety, even when the victor is presumed?
So what do you guys think?
Ooh, I mean, there is a certain satisfaction in like doing that final move and kind of finally kind of winning it out. If I was the person in that winning position, I would feel a little bit cheated by the, you know, you get that kind of endorphin rush of, yes, I did it. So, I mean, that's where I'd be coming from. Out of politeness, if I was the losing one, I would want to stick it to the end just to give that person that moment.
I think it really depends on the game and the number of players.
That's true.
If it's a two-player game and one person just doesn't have a chance, there's, you know, you've got three turns and then I'm going to win and you just want to get to another game. I get it. That's, I think, what he's getting at. I think that if both players agree, it's like, yeah, let's call it, play again, give you a chance this time.
And like you say, it's very context specific, because if it's a long game and those three turns are going to take a while, then I get it even more. If if those three turns are just going to take a minute or two, then, you know, why not just play them out?
Yep. I agree. I think it is really, really tied to the number of players. Two players, as long as you both agree, I'm completely right. However, sometimes it does benefit the losing player to play those turns, because you may come back. Maybe the game isn't actually lost.
Right.
And you don't know unless you play it through. I think quitting too soon is a problem. If you play, oh, we're two turns in, I screwed up, we're going to lose, so let's just start over. Then you don't really get better as the losing player. You know, you need to have that practice of coming back from behind.
Also seeing the strategy that the winning player is using, not just their opening moves, but how they build that engine or whatever it is that they're doing to get so far ahead.
Yep.
It's clearly a strategy that you can learn from. Seeing them make their moves.
I would say if it's a graceful concession, then sure. If it's a, I can't possibly win flipping the table concession, I don't think that's just good sportsmanship in general. And if you're playing a multiplayer game and you're clearly out of the game, you kind of need to stick it out, because you have to remember, it's like, it's the fun factor, right? We always talk about playing games is for fun. So if you have four people at the table and you're one person that's not quite enjoying it because something's not going your way, and you ruin it for the other three players, that's not really fair. Sometimes you have to take one for the team.
I like to ruin it by, if I know I can't win, just wild card.
Sure. And make it fun for yourself, and the other people have to react to it. It's the kingmaker thing, right? Like, I will have a little bit of control and who's going to win. But, yeah, I just think, don't walk away from the table if it's going to ruin the game for everybody else.
I think, though, especially if it's a two-player game where one person is very experienced and the other is not, and the person who's not experienced is like, oh, man, I messed that up. You know, I know I'm going to lose. I want a chance to start again. We've played it most of the way through. I see how this is going to play out. Like, you've got this card, I've got this card, you've got this card, done.
Yep.
Let's fast forward those turns and get to the next round, because I really want to learn it. That makes perfect sense to me.
Yep. So I don't think there's anything wrong with it. Just mind your manners. Be a graceful conceder.
That's true.
All right. Now onto my favorite segment, new games I own or have kickstarted. Basically, it's an excuse for me to buy games. And as a side effect, I also make people aware of new games, games you might have missed, and things you might find interesting on Kickstarter. I'm going to skip this segment this week. And the reason for it is the entire episode's about Kickstarter. I did Kickstart some role-playing games. I did not Kickstart any board games this week, I don't think. But again, we're going to move this all to on topic because it wouldn't be fair for me to take this and that. And I think our next segment is interesting and I want to give us a little bit more time to talk about this game.
So our last off-topic segment is going to be our game of today, where we talk about a game we've played recently and give our impressions of it. Today's game is Innis.
So Innis is... I didn't really know anything about this. I bought this at the same time I bought Great Western Trail. The art style doesn't necessarily match my aesthetics, but I could see how people could look at this and say, the art's amazing.
I really like it. Yeah. I think it's very interesting because the cards and the map look very different, but they make a cohesive playing experience.
Yes. The map and the way the map comes together is really, really cool. So the way Innis plays is you are... taking control. It's kind of a territory control game. So you want to get your clans in as many territories as possible, or occupying as many sanctuaries as possible, or controlling as many enemy clans as possible. So you're the chieftain of enemy clans. So those are the three victory conditions. You do that by drafting action cards. There are 12, 13 action cards in a three-player game. You add more for a four-player game. And the drafting in this is actually really interesting. So you take your four cards, you pick one and pass the three. Then you combine that with the three you get. So you have four cards, you take two. It doesn't have to be from the original one, and you pass two. Then you take three of the four now you have and pass one. So you can change your strategy every single time.
It made me really mad because one time I got dealt an amazing hand and I could only pick one card from it, and I had to hand Chris three amazing cards knowing he could get rid of the card that he'd already picked out of the other hand.
And take the other two.
And take two of the three I just handed him. And it was just like, I don't want to give you any of these.
Yeah, but I think it's a really cool drafting mechanic, yeah, though.
It's unique. Yeah. And I mean... I liked as well that the cards that you're drafting never change. You know, yep. In some drafting games, you know, there's level 2 cards come out, level 3 cards. As you proceed, more and more cards are coming out. But this was just a closed system of 12 or 13 cards. And so you got to learn them very quickly. Yep. And I often get a bit bamboozled by the amount of different cards in a game. And, oh, there's so many. And I don't know which ones are coming. This, I was like, okay, now I'm learning what the cards do. I can remember which cards are going to come out for the next round. It's the same cards again. And so it really allowed me to get into the game very quickly and easily. Yep.
But there's also the red deck, the epic story cards.
Yep.
Which you... can earn by playing the green action cards or by doing certain things regarding the territories you're in and pick up more of those. And those are like the action cards, but there's a ton of them and they're different every time and you don't know what's coming out.
Yeah, the red deck is the thickest of all the decks. And that's what adds kind of the unknown element. You never really know. If somebody has a red card in their hand, what's going to happen? You know, am I going to attack them and they're just going to totally, you know, screw me over because they have this red card? So, and then there's yellow.
Which is what Chris tried to do to me.
I tried. And then you so Kitty did win.
Who won?
Yeah.
Oh, it was me.
Yeah, it was a back and forth. So this game started out relatively slow, easygoing. You don't have to fight with each other when you invade. You can say, let's just not fight. And sometimes it's like, okay, sure. And then you get to the point where... So this is genius about the game. When you satisfy a victory condition, you have to spend one of your actions to say, I'm going to take this token. They call it a pretender token. And I put it in front of me. That qualifies you to win at the beginning of the next round. But now everyone else can try to negate whatever victory condition you had. So there's three different victory conditions, and they can try to negate it. They can take away a territory. They can move your guys out of a sanctuary.
Well, or get their own victory condition.
Or, right.
So if you're tied, and unless one of you is
the clear winner.
Yeah, then...
Yep. Yeah. Or you're the Bren. The Bren is like the first player marker and the tiebreaker if you have that thing. But that dynamic...
You get some other special powers during the game, yep, too.
The kind of the decision maker.
Yeah.
But that dynamic's amazing because I was so close to winning and I could have done it every single time if I'd only had a turn to get the pretender marker. But you guys would always stop me just before that. Mm. And I'm just like, ah.
And then one time I did get the pretender marker, because no one was really paying attention to what I was up to. And then I took it and everyone was like, kill Kitty.
Yep.
And I didn't win that round, but I won the next one.
Yep. Just out of nowhere.
Skin of my teeth.
Yeah.
Barely a win.
Yeah. So this map is made, it's almost.
It's a, they tessellate the tiles.
All right. Tessellated tiles. And they fit together.
Triangular.
Yeah, their side is triangular with rough edges, but the way they fit together, you can fit them together in lots of different ways. We were a little OCD and always made sure they were facing the same direction, but you don't have to. And it just makes this beautiful board. Like, the artwork on the territories is amazing. Mm. And every time you put a territory down, you take a yellow card, which is an advantage card. And if you have the most clans in that territory, you get the advantage cards for that round. So you can kind of like, oh, I really want to go to the hills because the hills gives me great defense. Or I want to go to the plains because from the plains I can take an action and I can invade everything around me. So you can kind of play those advantage cards as well. There was one you were using.
I was going to say, I'm trying to remember. I think it was the Moor.
Maybe the Moor.
Maybe?
Or the Veil.
The Veil.
Yeah.
I don't know. Josh took it from me at some point.
So that was how you were getting a whole bunch of red cards.
I was getting a whole... No, that was how I kept picking up the action card. So at the beginning of the draft round, you discard one of the action cards. And I had an advantage card that when I played an action, I could also take that action into my hand and choose whether I wanted to keep that one and discard one of my other ones or put that one back.
So you could swap the burn card, basically. So Innis is actually rated pretty high on BoardGameGeek. I think it's 258th or something, which is crazy high when you consider there's 20,000 games on there. But I wasn't expecting to like this nearly as much as I did. And I would play this again right away. It says 60 minutes on the box. It took us almost 2 hours.
Right about 2 hours.
Yeah, but we had to learn the cards. And play sped up quite a bit at the end when we knew what the cards were. I think the three of us could play this in 60 minutes if we played it again.
And once we knew what strategies to go for, I think me and Josh in particular, and a little bit you too, were just kind of, I'm going to keep taking steps forward and see where this gets me.
Yep.
Because I was going for a sanctuary strategy for a while there, and then all of a sudden realized, like, oh, I'm already in 5 territories. I just need one more.
Yep. I was trying to spread out, but I was trying to do it a little bit covertly so I could, like, hit 6 territories all at once. And then you made that first move where you got it and like, ah, and then it was a back and forth. As soon as Josh and I realized that you were in that situation, it was a war. So
there was a lot more battle that happened in those last 2 rounds.
Yeah. Verdict, give this one a try. It's really good.
Very cool.
All right. Let's do this on topic thing.
In this episode, we're talking about Kickstarter. It's been called the biggest boon to board gaming in recent history, but it's also loathed by as many as well. How can something be so good for the industry, but so bad for consumer? Let's talk about it.
Yeah. So I've kind of made the assumption that everyone knows about Kickstarter, and I don't know that that's true. So you guys, what is your guys' experience with Kickstarter?
I've Kickstarted a few things that are not board games. And I've looked into some board games, but usually Chris has already kickstarted them, so I just play his.
Oh, yeah. I just remembered I have kickstarted one thing. It was this thing called Gravity Light, and it's like a sort of social enterprise thing for places in Africa and third world countries. So, yeah, you get a real mix of things. Some of them are just consumer products from all different industries and things. And some are just like sort of, you know, social things and things to help people or services. But, yeah, it's really taken off with the board gaming world as well, it seems.
Yeah, if you look at my account, and anyone can follow me, I'm Steel22374 on Kickstarter. I think I'm definitely a super backer. I believe the last time I checked was like 77 funded games, and almost all games. I did Kickstarter Garden, so that should be coming relatively soon too. I'm addicted to it more so since I started the podcast. I would say we've done 31 episodes. I'm not sure there's an episode where I haven't said that I backed something.
I think there was one.
And I might have been lying on that one. I don't know.
It's possible.
Yeah. I love Kickstarter. But it is a problem. It's a problem. This is actually the intervention episode. because one of the things you have to do with Kickstarter is you have to constantly be monitoring it. It's really easy to miss things on Kickstarter that are going to be huge successful games. And so I spent a lot of time on Kickstarter. And
so
then
wait, why is it so easy to miss? Is that because it's just a short window that the Kickstarter's open for and then closes suddenly?
30 days and then it's done.
Ah, right.
Yep. So when that happens, you know, if you missed it, maybe there's like late backer stuff or something like that. But chances are you haven't even had a chance. You don't know when it's going to come out. So Arcadia Quest is a great example. Like, had I seen Arcadia Quest on Kickstarter when it first came out, I would have backed it. For $100, I would have gotten like tons and tons of extras, including an entire extra mini campaign. Arcadia Quest is a game by Eric Lang, published by Cool Mini or Not. Also, congratulations, Eric Lang. He's now the director of game design at Cool Mini or Not.
I saw that as well.
That's an aside. However, but when I bought the game normal, I just got the game. It was still like $90, but I didn't get all of the extra minis. I didn't get the extra campaign box. Then I had to go out and try to track them down. So I'm spending more money there. And that stems the I'm infuriated with Kickstarter exclusives.
Well, Chris is definitely a big completionist. He needs to have all the things. So I don't mind not having all the things necessarily. I think the base game is usually good enough. It's good for me. It's the base game because, you know, it's playable as it is. I don't need the special pink pyramids or
whatever it is. Kickstarter green, by the way. The pink ones were, anyway. But that's true.
It is. But also, I find that it can, you know, the one thing that can happen on Kickstarter is it can favor the people with more information. So the more hardcore people, like yourself, Chris, who know the Eric Langs of the world, you know, the infamous game designer who's, it seems every game he makes is just a smash hit and everyone loves, you know, you're going to know to kind of maybe follow him on Twitter or like you'll know easier and quicker where these pieces of information are coming. Someone who's a little bit less into the world, less knowledgeable, might not know, you know, where the good stuff is. And there can be a lot of stuff out there that's not as good, but might look good because they have a slick video yep. on their Kickstarter page, right?
Yep.
Which is why it might be helpful to look at people's Kickstarter pages. It is, you are able to see what other people are backing. You can look for people who saw these other games that you know are successes now, see what they're backing now. Yep. So look at someone like Chris or somebody else who's very into it. This is what they do. And you can see like, oh, they saw Gloomhaven coming. They saw Exploding Kittens. They saw all these big successes and jumped on board.
I have no excuse for that.
Somebody has to mention it. It has to be mentioned on a tabletop. Yeah. Podcast it, about Kickstarter.
It's true. And Exploding Kittens raised over $8 million, which was unheard of. I mean, it's basically a deck of cards, but still unheard of.
That's for like one of the biggest Kickstarters ever just on its own, right? Yep.
Until Kingdom Death a few months ago, which was $12 million plus.
So that's like the biggest, what do you call it, game-based? Or the just
biggest yeah. board game, yeah. highest game funded, yeah.
Right.
And if you look at the two games, Exploding Kittens was like a $20 thing. Right. So for them to get to $8 million, the amount of backers was insane.
Right.
For Kingdom Death, the average pledge was over $500 a piece.
Right.
But still, put those numbers together, $12 million at an average of $500 a piece. Like, wow. These are people. Now, Exploding Kittens was unproven, but it was cheap. And it went viral. Like, that's really what happened. Is social media. It's like, oh my God, this game, it's about kittens that explode. That's hilarious. And they had a not suitable for work thing, and they really pushed it really, really well. Kingdom Death, on the other hand, is a game that's been out for a while, and it's been out of print. And people have been wanting to get this game, so it had a lot of hype because people knew about it. By the way, this week I have...
Let's hear the damage.
I think I said that one last week. So, Esper Genesis, it's a heroic sci-fi role-playing game based on the 5th edition rule set of D&D. So, it's D&D in space. Customized anime collectibles from Hero Forged. It's Chibify. So, I backed them.
Oh, I saw that.
And I backed Wreckage, which I did an interview with Matt and Anton on Wreckage, and these cars are really kind of cool. So I backed to get the three cars because I think they'll be fun to paint and play with. So that's my Kickstarter for this week.
So those are all role-playing or miniature?
All of those are role-playing or miniatures. Yep. These aren't board games. I have 9 pledges right now that are currently just waiting to finish.
So we can talk a little bit about if you've never kickstarted something, the way that it works is there's usually multiple levels where you can get in just the basics. You get the product, then there's a next level up where you get the product plus a couple of extra things that you can only get for kickstarting at this level. Then there's usually like a you get everything level. And some I've seen with lots of levels. Some I've seen just one or two.
Yep.
Some it's just a kickstart us, please. And you put in your kickstarting pledge, like I'm pledging at this level. And you don't get charged until they meet their base funding goal.
Right.
And I don't know if we even explained this part of it to someone who's really, really new, is the fact that these people are coming here and it's not like an online store or anything. They're coming for investment money for a product they're going to make. Normally, they might have a prototype or a video showing this is what we're planning and hoping to make. And you're, you know, buying this future product in advance of them making it so that they can have that money to invest in actually making the thing.
Yep. And that actually leads to one of the contentious points of Kickstarter. The idea of Kickstarter is that it crowdfunds ideas. And the idea is, give me money so I can make this thing. And in return, I will normally give you a copy of whatever I'm making. So you're not investing in the company. Yeah. You don't have a stake in the game. You don't make money if they make money. None of that. You're just saying, for a game, for example, I will give you $50. You make this game and you're promising to give me a copy of the game if I give you $50. Or if I give you $100, you'll give me a copy of the game with fancy painted miniatures. And I can kind of choose the level I want. New game developers can say, okay, I have this much demand. I only have to print that many games to satisfy the Kickstarter backers. I have a little bit of extra so I can print some more copies that I can then push into retail. And voila, you have a game like Gloomhaven, which would never have existed without Kickstarter, but will probably be the game of the year for this year on every list. I'll say 80% of the lists out there, Gloomhaven will be the number one game of the year. And it may sit at number one in Board Game Geek for years to come. It's already in the top 25, and there's only 10,000 copies out there. That would have never happened without Kickstarter, which leads to stretch goals. So Gloomhaven came out with, I believe it was 6 character classes and a limited number of scenarios, like in the 40s or something. And as he met his goal, and he's like, well, if I meet this goal, I'll add this thing in. If I meet that goal, I'll add this in. And stretch goals can be one of these things where people sit. The last 6 hours of a Kickstarter, you can increase 25 to 30% of your overall pledge in just that, because people are waiting to see until the end to see what are all the stretch goals that I'm going to get if I pledge this money. And let's use an example real quick. Rising Sun. Have you guys heard of Rising Sun?
Yeah, I've heard of that, yeah.
So this is, Kitty's telling me no with her eyes. She's quiet, remember, she needs to drink before.
Sorry.
But perfect. she's still here, I'm still awake. Rising Sun is Eric Lang's next game, Cool Mini or Not. Cool Mini or Not, one of their biggest marketing strategies is Kickstarter. So anytime they publish something, it's a huge deal in the board game industry. They have 15 days left. This game came out with a goal of $300,000. That was hit within the first 15, 20 seconds. It is now up to about $2.5 million with 23,000 backers. This is a board game. Mm-hmm. This game is a $100 pledge. There are no other levels. You pledge $100 and you get the game and all of the stretch goals. And the reason why Kickstarter works for Cool Mini or Not is because they have awesome miniatures and they just keep adding miniatures and Kickstarter exclusives to their stretch goals.
And they have incredibly good designers like Eric Lang, sure, who is like a sort of rock star game designer. Right?
But I guarantee of these 23,000 people, most of them backed before there was any information on the gameplay. They launched this and there was almost no information on the gameplay.
Yeah, well,
they trust the company, they trust the designer.
Exactly, right.
Yep. So let's take a look at so there's another strategy people will use, and that's add-ons. Now, add-ons you don't get with your initial $100 pledge. But, oh, if you want extra dice, you can add on. If you want metal coins, you can get an add-on. So all of these are kind of not nickel and diming, but tens and 20-ing you. Mm-hmm. So you can get all of these extra pieces. And you also have the Kickstarter exclusives. And I'm counting this in real time. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19.
This is great
19,
radio, Chris.
19 currently, with 15 days left, Kickstarter exclusive miniatures or pieces of the game that you will get if you back it now.
I think even I'm going to have to back this thing. But it's not coming out until April 2018 or something, right?
Yes. It's over a year away.
Because this is another thing about Kickstarter is that, you know, you're putting this money down for something that they're going to make in the future, and normally it is this kind of length of time, like 6 to 9 months, maybe even almost a year.
Yeah, well, Cool Mini or not, it's very long periods of time. Yeah. But yeah, how can you not? Even if this game is terrible, the Kickstarter. Well, if it's terrible, you're not gonna make anything back. But if you have these exclusives, you can sell the exclusives and make back the money that you spent on your pledge. At least that's been the status quo of a Cool Mini or not Kickstarter. I am not promoting Rising Sun. I really am not. But if you want to spend
an example.
Just an example. But if you want to spend an extra $30, you can get a playmat.
Yeah.
Another $20, you can get metal coins.
Yeah.
Just add that to your $100 pledge.
Right.
So now I'm up to $150. We still have way more stretch goals to go, and there's going to be a ton at the end. So
I mean, this is good. You know, this makes it all sound wonderful. Like, you know, it's like, wow, this great game, and you can buy it and then possibly make all your money back with selling the exclusive if you wanted to. But I'm sure there must be horror stories in the gaming world, as just as there are in the non-gaming world for Kickstarter. I mean, I heard this story, and it wasn't for a tabletop game, but essentially these guys came out with this slick video about they were going to make some like wristband that projects an image of your phone onto your arm. And that's what they were going to do. And if you just pledge the money, and basically the idea was flawed from the beginning, and it was just a video. They didn't have the technology done. They said, oh, if you give us the money, we'll work it out. But they couldn't work it out. And so no one's got the product. And that's like real, real horror story, worst case scenario. But can you think of any times where it's been slightly negative? Maybe not that bad, where maybe the game just wasn't good, or, you know, I don't know. Where, have you got any anecdotes from your time?
I have one that has been outstanding for 3 years.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
2 or 3 years. This one is gamer mats. So this was for, it's a role-playing map. These are 8x8 tiled, hexed, or squared maps with magnets in the side. And you can put, draw anything on them, and everything erases from them, and you click them all together, and they're for role-playing games. They're amazing. He had prototypes of them. You could see them.
Right.
He planned on shipping it within like 3 months after the Kickstarter ended.
Oh, God.
He sent it out, you know, a few updates, the manufacturers having problems getting him samples and all that. He finally got samples and got sent back, and everything was off. The lines weren't right. The colors were all weird and off. So he's like, okay, we're walking away from this factory. We're going to find a different factory. I believe it's been almost 3 years, at least two. We were at the old apartment.
We were. We had not moved in here. It had to be three.
Yep. So it's still in the works. And he still sends updates. He put a second mortgage on his house.
Oh, wow.
So that he could actually get these things made, because he's very passionate about it. But I dropped $120 on that Kickstarter. I don't have that $120 anymore. I don't have the map tiles. And the way I cope with it is I just put it in the back of my head and don't think about it.
Yeah.
But that is the worst thing that's happened to me on Kickstarter. Mm. So board games are kind of easy. You kind of see if they're there or not, if they're working or not.
What about the ratio of, you know, games that you've liked to disliked? Do you kind of have a rough, like, sort of percentage in your mind? I mean, it's probably a bit easier for you to pick out the good ones from the bad ones than someone who knows much less, like, say, for me, to just go on Kickstarter and be like, okay, which games are going to be good?
I kickstart things for two different reasons, mm-hmm. primarily. There's probably other reasons too, but two main ones. One, because I know a game is going to be good. And I usually can know that by the designer, by the hype, by people talking about it. If it's funded within an hour and the funding goal isn't $500, because sometimes you'll see that. Funded within an hour, but we only asked for $20. So our next stretch goal is at $45. And you suddenly see 20,000% funded. Not talking about those ones. But if I know a game, like, you know, Rising Sun, that game's going to be fine. Even if I only play it once or twice, it's still going to be a good game. The other reason I fund it is because I'm trying to support new designers. And I don't recommend people do this because it is a lot of just risk on trying to support new designers. But I like supporting the industry, and I think Kickstarter is a good way of doing that. And those games are a little bit more risky, but sometimes it pays off. Or sometimes I spend $20 on a game and I only play it once or twice, but I've spent more on other games and not played them less times. So right. I'm still trying to get a number. I'm still trying to get the others to the table. That was $100 from Cool Meter or not. I still haven't played that one.
So what do you think of some of these companies where they probably have the money to go ahead and make these things and they're kickstarting them anyway?
Yep. It's the idea that Kickstarter is becoming a pre-order platform. Yep.
How do we feel about that?
I am actually completely fine with it for two reasons. I think people misestimate how big these companies are. Even Cool Mini or Not, which is a very successful game company, they still aren't rolling in capital. They still can't make a print run where they're just putting up the $2.5 million it's going to take to print all these copies of the game. They still have to know how well received a game is going to be. When I talked to John Zinzer about AEG, which was last Friday's interview as it dropped on the feed, we talked about Kickstarter a little bit. And this is the first time AEG used Kickstarter. And he's doing it for a reason. He's rebooting Thunderstone Quest. And they don't know how well received that's going to be. They can have some idea, but the Kickstarter allows them to know how many copies of this game could sell. If they get 10,000 backers, they can make 20,000 games and be confident that they're probably going to get rid of all of them without being stuck with a whole bunch of inventory. It's a strategy that has to happen in the board game industry right now. It's a big industry, but there's a lot of new games out there, and a typical print run. Do you guys know imagine an Innis. How many copies of Innis do you think was printed the first time?
I'm making guesses based on our interview with Stephen Bonacore.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to think.
I don't know, like 10,000.
That's probably what I was thinking.
Probably 2,000 to 3,000.
Oh, wow.
That's a typical print run for an indie board game or a small board game. If it's licensed, it'll be more. If they already have channels ahead of time, it might be more. But 10,000 is a lot. The Rising Sun is hugely successful. There's 23,000 people that are willing to buy this right now. Now, again, you can probably double that for real, but this is one of the most successful games that's going to be hitting the market next year.
And that's maybe 40,000 people who want to buy it.
That's maybe 40,000, 50,000.
And it's quite capital intensive as well, because you're printing a physical thing with all these other physical things inside of it. Like, it's not just a disc and the man hours created to create a video game. It's like real things that you have to manufacture and produce.
And for lots of people to complain about, because if there's anything wrong inside that box, you as an indie designer who put yourself out there, who really just wants people to play your game, you have to deal with all these negative comments about every little thing. You know, it's really hard for designers. Name is escaping me, designer of Scythe. He's basically gone on saying, I'm not ever going to do a Kickstarter again. There's just too much negative out there for me to try to do something like this.
Really?
Yeah.
That's weird, because like, he seems like such a smash hit game.
It is. And it was a very good success. But all he had to deal with was the negative that came back from...
He just didn't want that in his life. That's such a shame. So it's because people received the game and had negative things about it.
Well, whatever it was. The miniatures aren't good enough, or the boards are dumb, or the art, you know, whatever.
How can anyone say that about that game? That game is amazing.
People say it about a lot of games. You hear a lot of negative feedback about the quality of paper the cards are printed on, the way the minis fit, the... How come there aren't spaces for all of my things to sit in on my player board?
Do you think?
And even when you do have that, why do they wobble a bit? People can complain about anything.
But do you think that's just people in general? Or do you think the board gaming, like, sort of consumer is a little bit more, particular with these sorts of things?
I think the board game consumer is actually probably nicer than the average.
Wow.
I think the people who are willing to write emails are the picky people.
Yeah, right, that's probably true,
the people
too.
Who are, you're going to get more negative feedback than positive feedback.
Yes.
Just because when you like something, how often do you think, oh, I should sit down and write an email about how great this is? But if you think something's wrong, even if you don't mean to be a jerk about it, you think like, oh, I should give them feedback on this thing that like I think they could do better.
Yeah.
Even if you're just trying to be helpful, if you're bombarded with a bunch of helpful people saying mean things in a helpful way, it can feel a little overwhelming, I bet.
Yep. So I wanted to get other people's opinions on this. And for future reference, I'm going to be doing this for every show. Around Tuesday, I'm going to be posting to our Tabletop Game Talk podcast page on BoardGameGeek, let you know what the new subject is, and want to get your feedback ahead of time. So we did that. I tweeted it out. I got about a half a dozen responses here, and I just kind of want to cover some of the feedback here. Because I know how I approach Kickstarter. I know how some other people may approach it, but I want to get some listener feedback here. So if you want to participate before the show even airs, just go ahead and subscribe to our podcast, and you'll get a notification every time I post a new thread. So we're starting with Chrissy here. She says she occasionally backs, uses Kickstarter, has backed a variety of games, doesn't like the fact you have long wait times. So if you're instant gratification, Kickstarter is usually not the place to do it. I have got Kickstarter games within 2 to 3 months. I've mentioned about the space maps and the space minis. That usually is completed within 4 weeks after the Kickstarter closes. It's almost like just ordering it and you get it in the mail. Most of these things take quite a bit of time, though. A lot of people, especially new designers, they don't know all the time it's going to take. And a lot of these things ship from China, which is a 3 month on a boat. Let's see. She likes that it gives designers a chance that would otherwise not get their games into the world.
We did talk about this a little bit, that it can be overwhelmed by some of the bigger companies. But I actually don't think in the Kickstarter marketplace, I guess, that takes away from indie designers with small goals at all. Yeah.
To me, so I'm an application, like a mobile application developer during my day job. And when the App Store first came out for iPhone and eventually for Android, it drove software prices down to nothing. So basically, you had everyone just assume that all software was going to be free. Like when the first apps on the App Store were like $20, $30 because that's what shareware prices were going for, nobody bought it. So it was either a dollar or free. And it's because people just don't, you know, it's like I shouldn't have to pay for it. Everything should be free to me. But what ended up happening is even though those prices went down, the volume of sales went up and it created a place for anybody could write an app. And if people thought it was good, they'd throw a dollar your way.
Flappy Bird.
Yeah, Flappy Birds, yes. 10,000 of those people, you now have $10,000, less 30%. That is a great thing, even though it didn't look like one. Kickstarter's the same way. It allows indie developers to get out there. Now, you can't just make crap and have it work. You have to show something there. You have to have gameplay videos. You have to have interaction with the Kickstarter. But if you do, you have a chance of getting your game published. Mageling, it's a great little game. You know, it just barely made its funding, but it made it. And now he has a game out there. You know, that's cool.
And once you have one and it's good, people are going to keep coming back. And you really have that platform now to keep putting out more things.
Yep. So Chrissy's least favorite thing is stretch goals. Stretch goals are a marketing ploy. I promise you this. They know what their stretch goals are going to be before the Kickstarter starts. Mostly. Sometimes they actually legitimately do run out because they hit the thresholds they didn't expect. Stretch goals were meant to be part of the game. And if it's just like play stuff, it's like we'll add this expansion or we'll add this mode. They probably wanted to make that part of the game anyway. And it's just a way of kind of encouraging people to fund and keep coming back and checking what just got unlocked. You want to keep that buzz going. Sometimes stretch goals are legit though. If I only make 5,000 copies of a game, I can't put miniatures in there. It's too expensive. If I make 25,000 copies of the game, then I can put miniatures in there because it makes the cost per unit much, much cheaper. So sometimes you have to have that stretch goal so you can get your game out there, but have something cool that comes on.
It's funny because there's even like a kind of group of people who kind of speculate on these things. You know, when I first started Board Gaming London, this guy was like, oh yeah, I back everything by Eric Lang and I'll buy like 4 copies and sell 3 of them on eBay.
Don't do that anymore. Everyone's caught on.
Right, because then it's just oversaturated, and then maybe you can't sell it for the same, and you've just lost that money. So it's weird. It's almost like a little stock market going on.
Well, and I say don't do that for Eric Lang because, like I said, everyone knows, Cool Mini or not, Eric Lang, just get it. You can still sell the Kickstarter exclusives and make your money back, though. But Gloomhaven, imagine that you saw Gloomhaven and said, this game is going to be amazing. I'm going to get 100 copies.
Yeah.
You would have tripled to quadrupled your money in the last couple months.
Yeah.
Is that fair?
Well, that was part of the reason why I brought it up. Was like, how do we feel about it? You know,
I think Isaac would be fine with it.
Yeah,
you know, this one person that said, "Hey, I believe so strongly in your game." Well, it's kind of what retail would do, right?
Mm.
If I had a game store, I'm like, "This game looks amazing."
Do you want to be the Dwight buying all of the toys at Christmas and then selling them to desperate parents
for
marked up prices?
But there's no limit; everyone can back it. Now, I would not do this personally, and I have no entrepreneurial thing. Like I said, I gave away my extra copy.
Yeah, Chris definitely does not do this. Yeah.
But if somebody were to do that and sell it at a little bit of a markup, I'm not saying 3 to 4 times, they have a game that's in high demand, and they took that risk.
They did. You're right. I mean, I was going to say it kind of advantages people with more knowledge, you know the good designers, who know the industry well enough to say, I think this is going to be good.
They have put in their time, though.
That's true.
But
that's true.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's how buy, sell, low, sell, high works.
Yeah.
That's true.
So, I want to get to some of these others. I asked the questions specifically, have you ever used it? What do you feel about Kickstarter exclusives? What do you like most about Kickstarter, least about Kickstarter? And basically how you think it affects the board game industry. So Josh, who is also It's Gotta Be Odin, he thinks Kickstarters are great companies who run campaigns like Cool Mini or not, but in general, they think they're bad for consumers. That said, I have a really hard time backing a Kickstarter if there aren't any exclusives. I agree. If it's just a flat fee, I am less likely to back it than if there's exclusives or unlockable stretch goals. It is a purely a mental thing. They could say, here's $100 and here's everything you're getting for $100. I'm like, okay, that's a pretty good deal. Or they can say, all right, you're going to get 50% of it for $100 and here's all the stretch goals that you could get. I'm like,
if you spend more money.
Well, you don't have to spend more money. Oh. It's just when this happens, I'm going to be watching it. I'm going to be looking back. I'm going to, it's a
Chris is a sucker.
Yes.
Also, if it feels like you're hearing a lot from Chris during this segment, it's because Chris didn't put any of this out there for me or Josh to read. We're looking at a blank section.
Wait, where's he getting all this where this information from? I was like, what? I'm not seeing this.
So I'm not being quiet. Just throwing that out there.
So I will say, if you guys go to BoardGameGeek.com and go to the Tabletop Game Talk podcast page, you'll see that's a thread there, and I'm just looking at the thread.
I see.
So I cheated because I'm like, I don't need to copy all this into the notes, and I realized that.
Well, if you had told me that 15 minutes ago,
I'm going to turn this iPad right around, and you're going to read it. Let's see. What do you like most? I like seeing interesting ideas. What do you like least? The buy before you try. Some Kickstarters are getting pretty close to this of, like, they'll give you print and plays. And or at least the instruction book. I always want to see the rule book, because if the rule book's in a nice finished state and it's clear and you kind of get an idea for it, you can feel pretty confident.
They've already put in the work. You know it's probably been play tested. You know they've been thinking about it.
Yeah.
If it's just a big old mess.
Yeah. If it's not ready, you know. Yeah. I don't need to see print and plays. I'm probably not going to print it out. Thunderstone Quest just released a print and play. I certainly downloaded it. I looked at the cards. They're really pretty. I can't wait to play it. I'm not going to print it out and play it. I will read the rule books, which they also released.
But you're a rule book junkie, though.
I love rule books.
You will open a box and read a rule book and put the game back on the shelf and be like, I'm done with this now. Like, that's your satisfaction level.
I have made a March resolution, though. I'm going to play more games, more different games that I haven't played than I buy, at least for the next few weeks until I catch up on all the games that I have not played. So that's my section's going to be, maybe I'm limiting myself to one new game and one Kickstarter a week.
That's a good idea.
I don't know how long I'm going to be able to hold on to that, though.
Next week.
He's trying to manage his addiction. I applaud you for it.
Yep. Josh has mentioned that he does want to give special attention to early birds. Some Kickstarters have like early birds where if you back in the first 24 hours, you get a deal. If you're the first 100 backers, you get a deal. It's normally only a few bucks, but it does do a pretty good job at like kicking off that campaign. I've never successfully got to an early bird, but it's never been so different where I'm like, oh, I'm not backing it because it's going to cost me $4 more on this.
Right.
Let's see. Steve says he's only used it once to pack an expansion for Zaya, which I played a couple weeks ago. That game is incredible.
Ooh, what's it? What kind of game are we talking
about? It is a space exploration game, but it's kind of a space sandbox game. You can go around, you can trade, you can fight pirates, it's a pick up and deliver in space. You get to, it's like a little Tetris board to build your spaceship. So you have like shields that are different symbols and engines that are different symbols, and you'd have to try to fit them. You have to, like, this ship that has different spaces in it, and different ships have different spaces, and you're trying to fit all the pieces.
That sounds
cool. Yeah,
it is so much fun.
As soon as you say space, though, I know Chris is going to be on board with it. Chris was actually complaining about the game today, Innes. He was like, I really liked it, but you know, if it had been a space game, I would have really liked it, even if all the rules were exactly the same.
I said that to you with confidence.
Well, it was like, a nice like druid theme. I don't think it's Chris's style, but the art's really gorgeous. I mean, it's
very just, Celtic. Yeah.
Celtic.
With like a fantasy thing on there as well. So it's kind of Celtic druid-y. Yeah.
And has kind of a tarot card look.
It totally grew on me, I promise. It really did grow on me. Steve mentions that he has no problem with Kickstarter exclusives if they're aesthetic, so maybe alt art or promo cards. But for things that affect the gameplay, he thinks that should be part of the game. Let's see.
I'd say maybe if there's an expansion, like if the game is playable on its own, but you want to, for the extra money, buy an expansion basically at the start, then I think that's a little different. Yeah. But sometimes it's, you know, extra characters and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Extra characters, it's that really that borderline. You don't need it to play the game, but man, I really want to play the extra character. So, and for me, I have to have it all.
I guess it's just how it's sold to me.
So he likes that it gives new people a way of marketing their games. He doesn't like when publishing companies use it. They could produce the games by themselves, but are just using Kickstarter to add hype to their game. Sometimes that is. The games really do need hype, though. He actually mentions that this is the last thing games need, but I think it's the biggest things games need. Mm. A game is only as popular as the number of people playing it. Any kind of hype is good, and you don't ever want to pass up on that publicity. But I think most publishers actually do use it to get a sense of the market and to be able to fund larger print runs.
It mitigates so much risk, like we mentioned before, that it would be stupid not to do it. I think, it's a really smart thing to do. And like you say, it really kind of pushes the industry forward and like supports so many people that wouldn't be able to make games without it.
Yeah. I was going to say, it's not like there's a limit on how many Kickstarters there can be at one time. Right. There can be so many going on. It's not like they're taking away from the little guy.
No.
By doing it at all.
And the little guy still is going to make what he's going to make. I mean, there are people out there that have budgets that say, okay, I'm not going to back Kickstarters because I want to buy a game that I can play today. And if you have a cool mini or not versus, you know, a Joseph Publishing Mangeling, and you have to pick one, it's going to be hard for you to say, okay, well, I'm going to try this unknown designer with this unknown game, or I'm going to, holy crap, look at all these miniatures I get over here. So maybe if you're making that comparison, but Joseph's game still got published and he still gets to say, I did this, and knows the process and can do another game now. You know, so that's still cool. And that was from Kickstarter. Michael Ohl, I love Kickstarter, even more these days, having made friends with several small indie publishers in my local area. Indie publishers. I've used Kickstarter extensively. I found that I fund the creation of board games, role-playing games on it, sometimes video games to a lesser extent. I try not to back video games because those ones are far, far more likely to fail. People underestimate how much time it's going to take to make a video game. And it's millions of dollars to get a good game out there. Kickstarter exclusives are a mixed bag. It's cool to get promos and special expansions. It sucks when you miss the campaign and can't get them. I love that Kickstarter is that it exists as a way to get micro donations to make a dream a reality. This lets companies know that the product they wish to make is worth developing and they have enough demand for it. Particularly in board game industry, it allows developers to take risks they normally wouldn't because they can see the market potential with less chance of losing money on a product. So basically what we get back to, don't people think that these board game publishers are huge mega corporations? Stronghold Games, Stephen Boncour is a one-man show. And up until just recently, it was a part-time one-man show. AEG, been around for ages. It's a distributed company, and probably most of those people have different jobs outside of what they do for AEG. Cool Mini or not, they're actually a official company. They've made enough games where they can actually hire people and stuff. But it's the exception.
Yeah. Like,
there are so few game companies that are bigger than, you know, a handful of people, if that.
I remember hearing the story of the woman who invented Jenga, and she, you know, this was back way back when, and she had to like remortgage her whole house to get this thing off the ground. You know, she went to these big game companies and said, I've got this great thing, and they all turned her away, and she had to, you know, risk her whole like kind of livelihood and life on this idea she had. You know, if she had come up with that idea in today's Kickstarter realm, you know, she wouldn't have had that huge risk on her shoulders kind of thing.
Yeah. He does mention he dislikes the search on Kickstarter, which I completely agree with. If you're on the Kickstarter pick list, you're going to get far more attention. If you're not, I go through about 100 different game entries. Because I just search for board games. And it's like usually 100 new entries every single time I look. And that's a couple times a week. Kickstarter recommendations are getting better for me after 77 backed projects. They have an idea of what I'm looking for, but they're still not that great. You know, it's still kind of all over the place. So I agree. Kickstarter does need kind of a better search mechanic on there. Board Game Geek helps a little bit, but even Board Game Geek, you can put something there and, you know, people might never come across it. You know, it's like, well, what's the new things? There's a newsletter that you can subscribe to on BoardGameGeek, or just BoardGameGeek News, which will do like a Kickstarter wrap-up and kind of give you highlights of all the new Kickstarter games out there. So that's kind of useful, too, if you kind of want to pay attention to that thing. And he thinks that Kickstarter has really allowed a much faster growth of the board game industry. And I agree. Like I said, we're getting more varied kind of games, cooler games, better quality games, because there's just this huge, you know, competition out there now, and this easy way of getting out there. Mark my words, by the end of next year, I will kickstart a board game.
I have one of your own.
You heard it here first.
Yep, one of my own. Wow. I have two or three ideas in the back of my head. Prototyping them and getting them up to, you know, is kind of one of the things that slows me down, because I'm like, if it's going to take me that long to prototype, I don't want a game that takes so long to set up. I want a quick and easy game, but I loved designing games within the video game industry. I am going to design a board game. I am going to use Kickstarter to get it out there.
Oh, that'd be a good subject to do some sort of YouTube videos of us play testing yep. your prototypes and things.
And I will turn to the listeners too. So you guys, don't look for it in the next couple of weeks.
I'm putting bets out on whether or not it's a space exploration game.
Spoiler. I have three different ideas running around. I will tell you, like, one of them is you wake up with amnesia and you're trying to get out of a dungeon, but you don't know anything about yourself. So as you play through different turns, you'll reveal these random cards. So your alignment, your class, you know, your abilities.
Oh, yeah. I remember you telling me about
this. They're hidden. So it's kind of a hidden traitor where you don't even know you're the hidden traitor because you have amnesia. And then all of a sudden it occurs to you like, oh, I'm the reason everyone's down here and I need this particular item. And you need to kind of work with different people to get what you want, but you all have your own personal goals. So that's one. Another one is more of an overland fantasy where you have the city in the middle, which is kind of determined by a random card. So your city can change each time. You have four different regions that you pick your random regions again, and then each region has two different dungeons, and you're working on kind of creating the best fantasy adventure group that can go out to these dungeons and get the required artifacts to win the game.
Nice.
And then the space exploration one is actually inspired by Zaya. I want to do something that's incredibly fast to play. So just play really, really flows through, and you can get the experience of this space exploration game in under 90 minutes. So that's my goal, is to get that 4X feel in a small time frame, but not in a small game. So anyway, if you guys think any of those are interesting, let me know. But
nice.
I have one more feedback from Henry. So far, I've used Kickstarter 7 times. I've used it notably for Santorini, which is a game I bought. It's not here yet, but I've heard a lot of good things about it. So actually, Henry, the fact that you mentioned this, you were the straw, because he's like, which I absolutely love. I'm like, all right, I got to buy this game. Massive Darkness, which I've also backed. He's highly anticipating. Near and Far, which Kitty...
I'm so excited about this.
I saw Ryan Lockhart talk about Near and Far. It looks amazing. It's a cross between Above and Below and Gloomhaven. It's kind of like a Gloomhaven light.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It looks really awesome. And recently for Rising Sun, because he loves Blood Rage. He thinks Kickstarter exclusives are fine, but only if they add additional variability and replayability, such as additional characters. He doesn't care for them when they add game content for non-Kickstarter backers, which I think most people will agree. And I think Kickstarter will continue to be a part of the board game industry to help small companies and games gather a following. However, I see it being used more and more like CMON, which is Cool Mini or not, but their new name is now CMON. And bigger companies do as pre-orders services in disguise. I agree. But again, I think for the most part... Now, Cool Mini or Not did say that they're doing the other's Kickstarter... Oh, what was it? No, it was the house... They're doing Fire and Ice, which is their next game. They're going to kickstart the base set, but they're not kickstarting any of the expansions. So that is reasonable to me. Get an idea for the demand, get money for the initial print runs, and then they're selling the expansions just retail. They're not trying to kickstart those. I did a lot of talking.
That's fine.
I love this subject.
So I'm going to go out there and say I feel like I've been called out for not talking very much. It's because Chris picks the topic every week.
What's our topic next week? You pick it right now. We have one.
We do have one. But... And I like it, so I'm going to stick with it. Next week, we're talking about gateway games.
All right. And then I am going to take the back seat, and Kitty is going to play my role.
Oh, boy.
That's just down out, but it's going to happen. I do have one more bit of feedback. This is a friend of mine that works at a game store. He says, I hate Kickstarter. And he hates Kickstarter because he thinks it creates an exclusive... exclusive class of gamer. If I got in, I'm back in the Kickstarter and I got all these things, like, look at me, I was so cool. And you think that separates like those people who can afford to back all these games and take all this risk from the people who just want to play good games. I think it is a completely valid statement and thought. I don't know what the reaction to it is. I think it's here to stay, and I don't know how you can go around it.
Yeah, and the industry needs that money and that support and that risk mitigation.
Yeah,
considering how capital intensive making a game is and how hard it is as a small designer. You know, we've talked about this already, but yeah, I think it needs to be there. Yeah. But you're right. I mean, it does feel a bit awkward for some people. Think of it this
way. Kitty has a statement.
I think it's also about what they're giving away as the Kickstarter exclusive, and if it's, you know, you're kickstarting the game, it's supposed to be giving them enough that they can kind of go forward on their own. But I think a lot of games just kind of get kickstarted and then that was it. We're done now. They don't go on to the next level. A lot of these businesses where I've bought products on Kickstarter, it's to not just, oh, you bought the thing through Kickstarter. You're giving them a little bit more money than the thing is worth so that they can up their production, so they can keep making these things to sell them in a retail market. And if the games aren't making that leap, is that really what you're kickstarting? Is that really what it
should be? Well, are you kickstarting the game or are you kickstarting the business?
The company.
Yeah. Well, I will add, though, one of the things that maybe there is a class system in board games now, but one of the things is the people who are willing to back Kickstarters are bringing more great games out for the people who don't want to back Kickstarters to play. Maybe you're not playing the game with all the bells and whistles, with all the extra exclusives and all the alternate art, but that game wouldn't have existed if the people who weren't supporting Kickstarter weren't supporting Kickstarter. Yeah. So
I think as long as it has the same base rules, the same gameplay, there's nothing wrong with it. It's when you start adding the
when it's a different gameplay.
When it's a different game that you can't get anymore.
Yeah. All right. So I've gone 9 minutes longer than I should have. Once you're done reading all the stuff, I've gone 10 or 11 minutes longer. So if you have any feedback on this topic, though, please send it to us. We'll include it at the top of our next show. And Josh, why don't you take us out?
Indeed. Well, thanks for listening. And remember, we love your feedback. So consider leaving us an iTunes review. Thank you for the reviews this week, and email us with comments or questions at tabletopgametalk@gmail.com. You can also reach us at Twitter at tabletopgametalk, GameTLK, and directly at GameMasterChris, at JoshesBlonde, and at KittenL. And if you like what you hear, help us spread the word by liking or sharing our posts. Finally, a huge thanks to our patrons, Emil Jiljam, Jacqueline Hagar, Shane Poole, George, Jason Strong, Lucas Hartso, Charles Finch, Trevor Olson, Brian Arnold, Josh Arntz, Sean Kelly, Rudy Liu, C. Marie, Daniel Shepard, John Markle, Joseph Lee, Sam from New York, and Michael Ohl, and our other supporters. If you'd like to support us via Patreon, you can find out more at tabletopgametalk.com/Patreon. All patrons are auto-entered into all of our contests with bonus entries, so check it out. For more options to show your support, visit Support Us page on our website. Until next week, when we talk about gateway games, keep playing games, and having fun.
Good night.